Welcome to Broadcaster at Large. I'm your host and producer, Kelly O'Ramaris Watson. Beginning on September 7th, 2012, the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal held an historic proceeding against George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and six other Americans to try them on charges of torture and other war crimes. After four full days of legal argument and presentation of evidence, including the live testimony of three witnesses, the tribunal found all defendants guilty in a 21-page opinion they issued on Friday, May 12, 2012. One of the members of the prosecution team was Professor Francis A. Boyle, human rights activist and professor of international law at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. On Monday, May 14, 2012, Boyle and I discussed the significance of the tribunal and this proceeding. Let's start with some of the background on this Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission. Why was it started? How long has it been in existence? And what powers does it have?
Well, it was originally set up about, 5 years ago under the auspices of the retired Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad. And I was out there to help set the whole thing up. It's organized under Malaysian law. So it's not just some type of free-floating body out there or something like that. It was set up under Malaysian law, chartered under Malaysian law. And a few years ago, they had one proceeding on whether or not a president and other government officials were immune for the commission of war crimes and torture. And I went out for that, and the answer was no. And then last fall, they then prosecuted charges. I was part of that prosecution team against Bush and Blair for a crime against peace over their invasion of Iraq. And the tribunal unanimously ruled that Bush and Blair had committed a crime against peace by invading Iraq. And then the second charge that was prosecuted by the tribunal was against Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and several of the lawyers involved in the Bush torture scandal for torture and war crimes. And that was a four-day hearing. Defense counsel were appointed for the defendants who did not show up. And then at the end of the hearing, the judgment came down, ruling unanimously by five judges, four of whom were from Malaysia, one from Canada, all jurists, that Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bybee, Yu, Addington, and one other of the lawyers were all guilty of, Haynes of the Department of Defense, were all guilty of torture, the international crimes of torture, and crime, since torture in wartime is a war crime. So that verdict came down on Friday in Kuala Lumpur. Traveled all weekend long, and I'm back here in my office on Monday, May 14. Happy to know you're interested in the tribunal.
Why did Prime Minister Mohamad decide to form this? What is the stake Malaysia has in this?
Well, Prime Minister Mahathir had retired and I guess was trying to figure out how to devote the rest of his career. And he decided to devote it to opposing war. Malaysia is a peaceful country since their independence. They haven't engaged in warfare against anyone, even though they have claims against Thailand and, Singapore sort of went its own way there. And so he called me and some others out to work with him on this project. And one of the things I had suggested to him was that since war was already illegal under the terms of the Kellogg-Graham Peace Pact of 1928 and the United Nations Charter, the next step was to criminalize war, not just make it illegal, but criminalize it. So he and a group of Malaysian jurists whom I met with thought that would be the direction to go. They set up an advisory committee with some former UN officials in there, Dennis Halliday, Hans von Sponeck, both of whom resigned in Iraq, claiming the sanctions against Iraq were genocide. And we all agreed to move forward on this project to criminalize warfare. So the organization was set up with a mandate to do this. And then it had different arms. It had a secretariat. Then there was a War Crimes Commission. There was a tribunal. And then there was the prosecution team and also providing for defense counsel. So the various matters were submitted to the War Crimes Commission, and they decided, not me, they decided that the first step would be dealing with the war against Iraq. So they formulated an indictment against Bush and Blair for a crime against peace, and then sent it to us, the prosecution team, to prosecute. And they also decided the second charge would be for torture, and forwarded a second indictment against Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and four lawyers involved on torture. So the second charge just concluded last Friday.
Why does Malaysia have jurisdiction over these issues that deal with Iraq?
Actually, this was extensively argued by the defense counsel, arguing that they did not have jurisdiction. And my response, the prosecution team's response, was that there is universality of jurisdiction for any state government or court to try international crimes such as crimes against peace, war crimes, and torture. So if you have a look at the judgment that should be available at their website, you will see that they unanimously rejected this attack on their jurisdiction and concluded that they were exercising universal jurisdiction. For example, just recently, Bush was going to give a speech in Switzerland, and I worked out there with Swiss human rights organizations who got a member of the Swiss Parliament to publicly demand from the Swiss prosecutor that if Bush showed up in Switzerland, he should be prosecuted for the commission of international crimes, that Switzerland had jurisdiction to prosecute for these crimes under the implementing legislation for the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. So that demand was made publicly, and when it got back to Bush, I take it his lawyers advised him not to go to Switzerland. So he never went to Switzerland. That was really our first victory against Bush anywhere. But this in Malaysia is the first court that has ever found him to be guilty of anything, as well as Cheney and Rumsfeld, Blair, and then the lawyers for the torture memos. So it's a significant step forward in trying to hold these individuals accountable for what they did. I did work with lawyers up in Canada three times to try to get Bush prosecuted up in Canada when he was speaking, but the Canadian government intervened all three times to abort the legal proceedings. Attempts had been made in Germany. The German government intervened to abort those. Attempts were made in Spain. These are by other lawyers, not me. Germany and Spain. The Spanish government intervened to abort those proceedings. So it's a step forward in holding them accountable, and we certainly hope it is going to encourage other courts in the world to hold similar proceedings to find these individuals guilty and to track them down, put them on trial, and put them in jail. It's going to take time, obviously. You know, I take it it's going to take several years before we get Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the rest of them hauled before a court personally and incarcerated. But we're working on it. I know I'm working on it. Now, the Kuala Lumpur Secretariat and War Crimes Commission is working on it. I know the Center for Constitutional Rights is working on it. The American Civil Liberties Union is working on it. There are human rights lawyers all over. The European Center for Human Rights is working on it. Canadian lawyers are working on it. So, you know, you have sort of a battalion of lawyers and NGOs out there working to bring these people to justice.
Okay, now you said various governments stepped in and aborted the proceedings. How did they do that?
Well, that's been revealed by WikiLeaks, that the U.S. embassies basically made threats to the governments involved to avoid the legal proceedings, and so pressure was put on the prosecutors being government officials, to abort the proceedings. In Spain, they moved Judge Garzon off the case and gave it to another guy who caved in. And then they went after Garzon on some trumped-up proceedings left over from the Franco era. So that's what we're dealing with, the U.S. government working behind the scenes to apply pressure on governments. Prosecutors usually work for their governments and pay their paychecks. So what can I say?
The defendants didn't show up. In fact, Cheney's recovering from a heart transplant. Who defended them, and what were their arguments besides the jurisdictional one?
In both proceedings, there was a defense team appointed to represent them. There are about four Malaysian lawyers out there representing them. Obviously, it was a difficult case for them to defend because Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld all made public statements repeatedly incriminating themselves in war crimes and torture. So that became a very difficult case. If you have clients who are so arrogant with power that they incriminate themselves publicly, and we introduce numerous statements by Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld that this is what they had done from the public record, from their memoirs, from interviews and whatever, it becomes very difficult to defend. So the best defense they could come up with was this bogus advice of counsel that their lawyers had told them that the steps they were engaged in did not amount to torture. So we did have to deal with that issue. I argued to the tribunal that, in fact, these memoranda were completely bogus. They were concocted by these lawyers for the express purpose of trying to set up a defense known as advice of counsel, and therefore the lawyers themselves became aiders and abettors and co-conspirators and part of a joint criminal enterprise with the three principals to commit torture and war crimes. And this was very extensively argued on both sides, and at the end of the day, the tribunal agreed with us unanimously on that point. So John Yoo, Addington, Judge Bybee, that's a disgrace. He should be thrown off the bench, impeached, disbarred. Haynes and other names came up in the proceedings, although they weren't indicted. Goldsmith at Harvard Law School, Delahunty at St. Thomas Law School, were all part of a criminal conspiracy to violate the Geneva Conventions, to violate the Convention Against Torture, to violate the U.S. Government's own anti-torture statute, and to violate the U.S. War Crimes Act of 1996. You know, I argued that point quite extensively, and the tribunal agreed with me. Indeed, I quoted verbatim from U.S. Army Field Manual 27-10, the law of armed conflict that's directly on point on all of these issues. And as I told the tribunal, look, if the U.S. Army Field Manual that is still valid and binding on all U.S. armed forces and civilians somehow engaged in warfare, including President Bush, who's commander-in-chief of the armed forces, Cheney, number two, and Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, if their own field manual makes this very clear, then they really have no defense, or the defense of advice of counsel should be rejected, and the lawyers found part of a criminal conspiracy and aiders and abettors to torture and war crimes. Aiders and abettors become, under U.S. federal law, international law, principals in the first degree. So the tribunal did agree with me. I think some of the people in the audience felt that citing from the U.S. government's own field manual on the conduct of warfare was conclusive on all of these issues. And I also cited the Nuremberg Charter judgment and principles, the Convention Against Torture, and the Geneva Conventions. Those were our primary sources. And then we had extensive documentation from the public record. And we had three live witnesses subject to cross-examination were victims of torture, and statutory declarations from two other witnesses made under oath, although for a variety of reasons they couldn't come.
Your live witnesses, what did they say, and who were they?
Well, one was a fellow Beg, British citizen. He was in Guantanamo and picked up in Pakistan, extensively tortured. Second, a guy from Iraq who was extensively tortured at some of the bases there subject to U.S. control, as well as Abu Ghraib. And the third, a woman, Jamila, who was a chief of the Iraqi Union. She was not really a government official. She was a union official. And she also was extensively tortured. And indeed, according to her testimony given under oath and subject to cross-examination and not disputed, was used as a human shield, she and her family, by U.S. Armed Forces. It's the first instance I am aware of, having followed combat in Iraq from the beginning, where we have a documented case of U.S. Armed Forces using a woman, a civilian's, as human shields. But there it is. It did make it headlines, I think, in the New Straight Times, but so far it's been censored here in America. I did publicly condemn this as a war crime and a cowardly and despicable act, and demand that the Pentagon investigate it. I kind of doubt they will.
What are some of the important particular points of the judgment?
Well, basically, we won on every argument we made, which I was very happy to find. I think the critical part for me was my opening argument on the Nuremberg Charter judgment and principles, saying that torture and war crimes at stake here violated the Nuremberg Charter judgment and principles, and therefore, legally, they were akin to the same types of war crimes that the Nazis had committed, although certainly not on the same scale of millions of people. And in my opening argument, I did cite Mr. Justice Robert Jackson, who took leave from the U.S. Supreme Court to prosecute the case at Nuremberg, where he said, we are creating one system of law here to be applied to the defendants and to ourselves. So I told the tribunal that that's a fair exercise. Mr. Justice Jackson called for it at Nuremberg, and that's what I'm asking you to do here, and that's what they did. It's a 21-page opinion, but I think the paragraph dealing with Nuremberg accountability is one of the most powerful in there.
The tribunal has no enforcement power, but will recommend to the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission that it submit the finding of conviction, together with a record of the proceedings, to the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, as well as the United Nations and the Security Council. The tribunal has no enforcement power, but will recommend to the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission that it submit the finding of conviction, together with a record of the proceedings, to the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, as well as the United Nations and the Security Council.
Now, what's the practical result of this judgment? Can it really be enforced, or is it just symbolic?
We'll try to get it enforced in any other court we can on principles of international comity that permit the courts of one state to enforce the judgments of other states. I certainly believe this is now prima facie evidence that they have committed torture and war crimes. And under the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture, all of them then, wherever they may travel, those states then have an obligation to apprehend them, prosecute them, or else extradite them to another state that will prosecute them. So, you know, it's just like trying to enforce any other judgment given in international law.
Former Liberian President Charles Taylor, now convicted of war crimes and crimes against humanity by the Special Court for Sierra Leone has called for the prosecution of George W. Bush for similar crimes. In a statement he read before the court, Taylor said, "President George W. Bush, not too long ago, ordered torture and admitted to doing so. Torture is a crime against humanity. The United States has refused to prosecute him. Is he above the law? Where is the fairness?" While Boyle was in Malaysia, a story hit the internet that President Obama had signed an executive order placing the United States under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. Apparently, this story is false. No such executive order is posted on the White House website. However, the rumor did inspire me to ask Boyle what such an action would mean.
Depending on what it said, if he signed this executive order, then that would undo the attempt by the Bush administration to unsign the International Criminal Court statute that was signed by President Clinton. President Clinton signed the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court, and then shortly after Bush came to power, and obviously in contemplation to going to war against Iraq, and with all this torture going on already, he had John Bolton send a letter to the UN Secretary General basically trying to unsign what President Clinton signed. So perhaps this executive order tries to undo that. I really can't say, but if he does undo it, that's a good sign, because then the U.S. would be under an obligation to act in a manner so as not to defeat the object and purpose of the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. In fact, I already have a complaint pending at the International Criminal Court against Bush, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Ashcroft, Gonzalez, Tenet, Rice, and Powell, and some of these lawyers, for the Bush policy of extraordinary rendition, which I argued to the ICC prosecutor is a euphemism for the international crimes of torture and the enforced disappearance of human beings, kidnapping them. Those issues did come up, too, in Kuala Lumpur. So that complaint I have is currently being investigated by the ICC, and you know, if Obama signed this, maybe it would encourage them to move forward and ask for an indictment against these individuals. I don't know.
If Obama did do this, is he opening himself up to a prosecution?
Well, of course, that can happen. You know, I don't wish here to... in this context, to comment on that issue, because I'm simply right now dealing with Bush. And in the case of Bush, we have most extensive documentation of everything that they did. With respect to Obama, the record is kind of sparse as to what he has been up to. I'm not trying to exonerate or exculpate President Obama at all. But I will say, back in last summer, even the Washington Times wrote an editorial in Washington, D.C. there saying Obama had better be careful consorting with the International Criminal Court, because there's this guy named Boyle who's already filed a complaint against Bush, and someone might file a complaint against Obama. I haven't filed a complaint against Obama because, as an attorney, before I take legal action against someone, I have an ethical obligation to investigate the facts and the law. Well, the law is quite clear, but the facts on Obama are simply not as extensive or detailed or anything else that we have on the Bush people. So I wouldn't be in a position to put together a complaint or an indictment given the facts we have now. Now, Cy Hirsch did give a public address, a speech, saying he felt, he believed on his sources, Obama was continuing pretty much everything Bush did, and he was writing a book on it. So, you know, I'd like to see Cy Hirsch's book. But, you know, you just can't take legal action against someone on the basis of press reports. Technically, that's hearsay, so you need a lot more than just press reports. And in our prosecutions of Bush and the rest of them, we had a lot more than press reports. So we had official documentation, hearings, you name it, everything coming out of your kazoo you could possibly imagine, we introduced. So I'm not ruling it out, but we're going to need more facts on Obama before we can put together a complaint. The complaint I had against Bush and the rest of them before the ICC was 80 pages, single space, of extensive documentation and not just press reports. So I just don't have that documentation yet on Obama. It could be coming. We'll see what happens. Right now, I'm pretty busy going after Bush and the rest of them. I do want to make it clear, one of the points I made to the ICC prosecutor, I was intending to send a shot across the bow of Obama and the rest of them, that if they did not cease and desist from the Bush practices, they very well could be next. So I did intend to send a shot across the bow. But that's different from, you know, actually going forward and pursuing legal action.
Do you want to say anything else about the proceedings or tribunals in general?
It's up to us American citizens to demand that these U.S. officials be prosecuted. So far, President Obama has refused to do so. He has an obligation under the Convention Against Torture and the Geneva Conventions and the Federal Anti-Torture Statute and the U.S. War Crimes Act to investigate and prosecute them. And I think we all have to demand this, that these proceedings be instituted here in the United States. You know, we can't, as American citizens, rely on some foreign tribunal to pull our chestnuts out of the fire. What has led me to Canada and Switzerland and now Kuala Lumpur is the statement by Obama and Holder that they will not prosecute any of these Bush officials. But, you know, those are just policy statements. They can always change their minds, especially if they get elected to a second term. We get a new attorney general. So I think we American citizens have to demand that these American war criminals be prosecuted here in America. Otherwise, we'll try to get them somewhere else.
You have been listening to Professor Francis A. Boyle, human rights activist and professor of international law at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. More information, including the full judgment of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, can be found on the website of the Kuala Lumpur Foundation to Criminalize War, www.criminalizewar.org. That's criminalize with an S, not a Z. The tribunal invited and received broad-based media coverage from around the world, except the mainstream media of the United States. This has been Broadcaster at Large, theme music by David Watson. The email address is broadcaster@inbox.com. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris Watson in Oakland, California. Thanks for listening.